Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 180. I'm recording it on Monday, October 12, 2009. The P10 level today is 19. That's less than exciting. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Basement Floor. The title of the podcast is Volatility is Evil. A price increase does not permit us to recover from the economic damage caused by a price drop. I recorded a podcast not too many back. I'm looking for the number. It was called, is it 176? Number 176 was called Volatility is Optional. I think that's one of the most important podcasts I've done. Put forward a provocative claim, not a claim that I have total confidence in. I'd put my confidence in that one at about 70%. So that's not at all high confidence. I personally believe it's true today, but I need to hear smart people discuss the idea and try to poke holes in it before I would have a high confidence in it. But if it's true, it's earth-shaking. I mean, if it's true, it can't be overstated. The claim was in podcast 176, volatility is optional, is that if investing were rational, the passive investing model, the dominant model of today, assumes rationality. It says that all inputs, all things that affect stock prices, are already present in the price. This is why you hear claims that you can't beat the market, timing is impossible, all this sort of thing. The idea is that there's all these things out in the world that affect stock returns. And people used to think you should try to uncover these things. You should try to, figure it out. And that's sort of what the investing game was all about, the stock investing game. But this passive investing model, which was developed by academics starting in the 1960s, and then it was made an investing model, I'd say, by John Bogle. By Burton Malkiel, wrote a famous book about it, Random Walk Down Wall Street, in the early 70s. And then Bogle founded the Vanguard Group of Funds to promote this idea. And so this academic idea was given practical implementation. But the idea is no sense trying to figure stocks out, because there are all these smart people out there doing the same thing. And they've already figured everything out, and they've incorporated all that knowledge, all those information bits, into the price. So you can't do better than they've done. You can't do better than the market. You can't beat the market. So this is the whole reason why people are told to invest passively. They're said, you can't beat the market, so you can't beat it, join it. Just do what the market does. Accept the market return at all times. Never try to beat the market. The rational investing model rejects that premise out of hand. Rational investing model is the opposite. Rational investing model says you can beat the market and you must beat the market. And if you don't, sooner or later, you're going to suffer devastating losses. And you're going to delay your retirement by probably 5 years. But the rational model does not say that you can engage in short-term timing. It doesn't say that you can predict how stocks are going to do over the next year or two. But what it says is that the price set by the market, it does reflect all information bits. That part is true. And some of those information bits are valid, rational information bits. But the trouble is, some of those information bits are pure emotion. So if investors get all kinds of crazy ideas in their head, one of those crazy ideas being passive investing, the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically, if investors get that idea in their head, that crazy idea gets reflected in the price. So it's not just good ideas that get reflected in the price. It's not just intelligent ideas or reasonable ideas. It's also crazy, knuckleheaded, emotional, desperate ideas that get reflected in the price. And if that's true, then the price is often not at all right. The price is often wildly wrong. And the only way you can know what your allocation should be is to perform an adjustment to the market price. That adjustment is performed by figuring out how much of the stock price is craziness and how much is rational. And it sounds like that would be incredibly hard to do. A lot of people might look at that and say, can't do that. But really, all you have to do is look at valuations. You have to have a legitimate valuation metric. We use PE10. That's the price of the index over the average of the last 10 years of earnings. PE10 has been recommended by big name experts, Benjamin Graham and Robert Shiller, and has an excellent track record for properly assessing valuations. And PE10 tells you how overvalued stocks are. And the overvaluation, this is all so simple and basic, but so important. Overvaluation, by definition, is improper pricing. That's what it means. I don't know what these passive investors think the word over, what do they think the word over means? Stocks are overvalued, yet they are priced properly? It can't be. If overvaluation exists, passive investing cannot work. And the same people who endorse passive investing will talk about overvaluation. They'll write an article recommending passive investing, and at the bottom of the article, they'll talk about overvaluation. You see this all the time, but it's a conflict. If you believe in passive investing, you have to believe the market's efficient. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And if you believe the market is efficient, then you believe the market is priced properly. And if you believe the market's priced properly, there can't be overvaluation. It's like saying, water is wet and dry at the same time. It's either wet or it's dry. It's not both. They're opposites. Overvaluation is the opposite of proper pricing. So the theory, this is as basic as it can get, obviously, but the fundamental questions are always the most important. The premise that I put forward, the argument that I put forward in the earlier podcast, volatility is optional, is that if we were rational, if we would educate investors, this is the key to everything, if we would educate investors about what really works, and of course, there's no reason we shouldn't, educating investors is a win-win-win-win-win. Everybody gains. There'd be fewer busted retirements. We would do away with these economic crises that are caused by out of control markets swinging back and forth. Businesses would not fail. Everybody benefits. Every single person alive benefits. We could, if we all were educated about the realities of stock investing, and if we all invested rationally, what would be priced into the market price would be not just what's happening today. Like, for example, today we're living through a recession, and that brings stock prices down because it brings profits down. And so people say, profits are low, stocks aren't worth as much. That's not true. Not if you're a long-term investor. What stocks represent are a long-term claim on a long-term dividend stream. And the dividend stream isn't damaged by a temporary recession. Yes, it's true that profits are lower today than they say they were back when stocks were priced higher. But we should be counting in not only today's returns, but the returns that we're going to see with the recovery from the recession, which is going to be very high. And of course, when we were pricing stocks back when times were better, economic times were better, it wasn't only the good times that should have been factored in, but this recession should have been factored in. And so the net effect is the long-term value proposition of stocks was the same both times. U.S. productivity is sufficient to generate a 6.5% real return annually, roughly. And so that's what should stocks should be returning if investors were rational. 6.5 every year. Every year. According to this theory. This is a theory I've put forward. If that's true, volatility is optional. There's no need for stock volatility. If we educate investors, and what we need to do is provide them a tool. And the tool is the stock return predictor, calculator at my website. The stock return predictor performs a regression analysis of the historical data, and using that regression analysis, it tells us at the various PE10 levels, what is the most likely 10-year return? And surprise, surprise, the stock return predictor tells us just what common sense tells us must be so. It tells us that whenever the valuation level goes up, the long-term return for stocks goes down. And whenever the valuation level goes down, the long-term return for stocks goes up. Well, what lesson is being taught? If you follow the stock, if you use the stock return predictor to set your stock allocation, what lesson are you being taught over and over and over and over again? What you're being taught is that volatility doesn't make sense. That every time the PE10 level goes up, the long-term return goes down, so you're going to sell stocks. And if everybody did that, then the price of stocks would, of course, fall. And once the price of stocks fell, the PE10 level would fall, and the long-term return would go up again. So the stock market is self-regulating. This is our most important insight of all. The stock market is self-regulating. If only investors could learn the realities. Right now, there's a lot of resistance. The big name experts who have promoted passive investing don't want, I think it would be fair to say, that, you know, they're not real excited about the idea of middle class investors learning these realities. They don't want to say those three magic words, "I was wrong." But if investors understood that when stock prices get out of hand, the long-term return goes down, there's no reason we would even experience much volatility in the future. Stock prices would be self-regulating, and what we would see is a price gain of roughly 6.5 real each year. Not precisely so, but something in that neighborhood. The PE10 value would probably vary from 12 to 18, something like that. So some years you would see a 5% return, and some years 7, but it'd be something in that neighborhood. You wouldn't see these 30% returns or 50% losses. Volatility is optional, or so at least I tentatively claim. And I think that's important. If volatility is optional, what we're really saying is that risk is optional, that stocks can continue to provide fantastic long-term returns after the risk is removed. And what a wonderful, wonderful world that would be for all of us. So I want to get the word out. I want to educate middle-class investors to the extent possible about the realities of stock investing, about what the historical data says, about the effect of valuations on long-term returns. I want to get the stock return predictor into the hands of every middle-class investor alive and every expert. And I want the experts, if they find holes in what I'm saying, to you know, point out those holes, because I don't want to spread wrong stuff. And I don't like this weight on my shoulders. You know, I'm recording these podcasts like a madman trying to get the word out. And I'm just some guy who posts on the internet. This is not my place. We need lots of big name people participating in these discussions. But, you know, if they don't do it, somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to pick up the ball. The academic research has been showing for 28 years that valuations affect long-term returns. And if valuations affect long-term returns, passive investing makes zero sense. So, the earlier podcast claimed volatility is optional, which essentially means risk is optional. This podcast claims volatility is evil. Now, I don't think there are many people who would say they like volatility, so in a sense, I don't really need to make the case, but I want to make the case because there might be some aspects of volatility, some negative aspects of volatility that people have overlooked. And I really think you can boil down the rational investing model to It's always good to simplify things to the extent they can be simplified. And really, all rational investing comes to is it's the anti-volatility stock model. That's really what it is. What passive investing is the anti-allocation change stock model. For some reason, they fastened onto this idea that people should never change theirs. Well, it's the pro-market. It's the market-oriented. That's what it is. You know, I had this discussion with the guy who runs the Monivator blog, and we had a pretty good back and forth, and he said he's a passive investing advocate, and he said, you're trying to come up with a scheme to beat the market. And I said, well, I object to the word scheme. And he says, well, sorry, that's what it is. It's a scheme to beat the market. I said, well, okay, if valuation-informed indexing is a scheme to beat the market, passive investing is a scheme to beat common sense. And I think that's right. From his perspective, I am indeed coming up with a scheme to beat the market. He's just horrified that somebody would try to beat the market. He thinks the market is it. The market is God. The market's his guide. And I say no. I say common sense is my guide. Common sense says the price you pay for something must affect the value proposition obtained from it. So it makes no sense to ignore the price you pay for stocks. It makes no sense. It defies common sense. So we both have good positions. You know, from his standpoint, he says, look, the market sets the price. I'm not going to argue with the market. The market's bigger than me. And I say, I don't care how big the market is or how many smart people are in the market. If they cook up a price that doesn't make sense to me, I'm not putting my money in. Common sense is my guide. And you can't have both. It's an either or. Either common sense is your guide or the market is your guide, because the two are in conflict. When stocks are overvalued, they're in conflict. When prices are moderate, they're not in conflict. But when stocks are overvalued, as they were from 1996 through 2008, common sense and the market are in conflict. Which you're going to go with? So the rational model is all about an argument that we should try to avoid volatility. And I have a set of podcasts, there were four of them, that I recorded a long time ago now, almost a year ago. And they were called, it was called The Future of Investing. And it was different ideas I had. And there were four podcasts. There's a set of them back at the early days of the podcast. And there was, the idea was to give, I don't know how many I gave, 30 different ideas for how to, you know, improve stock investing, make it more rational. But the biggest thing and the common theme in a lot of them was we just need to help middle-class investors understand. They have to understand that price has consequence. You know, that's the theme over and over again. And so I think when, you know, you see the S&P number reported everywhere. You know, it's omnipresent. Same thing with the Dow. It's on the radio. It's on television. It's on websites. I've thought of creating a widget. You know, these widgets can be attached to blogs. They're just little tools. And I'd like to have a widget that just tells people at whatever S&P level applies, what the most likely 10-year return is. So that every time the S&P number is reported, you would get this information. And that would just balance everything out. Instead of, you know, people hear, oh, the S&P went up, you know, 100 points today, and they're excited. They think that's good. Or the Dow went up 100 points. Dow is what I'm thinking of. Goes from, say, 9,000 to 9,100. And they should hear that the long-term value, the 10-year likely return, the most likely 10-year return dropped by X amount. I don't know what the number is for a 100-point gain, but it drops. And that would balance it. Then it's not that they'd be hearing bad news. It's that they'd be hearing a mix of good and bad news, which is reality. See, what's going on, it's a circular argument. What's going on is the passive people are saying the market's always right. But the trouble is the market would be right if only people had the information they needed to make it right. It should be right. But the people don't have the information. They don't understand that every increase in the S&P or in the Dow causes a negative. Every increase in price causes the long-term return to drop. And every drop in price causes the long-term return to increase. So every price increase has a, both a positive and a negative, a short-term positive and a long-term negative. And every price drop has a short-term negative and a long-term positive. That's reality. And 6.5 return for the year is the non-volatility return. That's the return that is just natural. That's the return justified by the economic realities. So that doesn't cause the long-term return to increase or decrease. You just cash that in because that's what you, that's the payment for giving up your money, giving up control of your money for a year to permit it to be invested in U.S. businesses. The payment is 6.5 real. So you just get that money. And you know, I've always thought that we should have a tool. We may try to incorporate it into the next calculator we're doing where every year, you know, I try to make things simple so that they're just clear to people. But the way I try, and my mind is simple. So I think about these things in simple ways. But if you just go through the record of stock history and, you know, you could look at a chart that would give you the S&P for every year, say going back to 1921, and, it could give you the return. You know, the real return. 1 year it's 5% real return. 1 year it's 10% real return. 1 year it's minus 1% real return. Every year, we should just have an adjustment for a number that shows the built-in, what's the word we could use? The built-in gain or loss. In other words, if you had a 5% return, say we had a 5% return. Say we start at fair value, and then the next year we have a 5% return. Well, the return should have been 6.5, so you have a built-in gain of 1.5% for the next year. It's not necessarily going to be realized in 1 year, but someday in the future you're going to get an extra 1.5 a return. That's built in now, since you only got 5, and it should have been 6.5. Then the next year you have a 10% return. Well, now you had a built-in return for the future of 1.5. Now you have a built-in loss of 3.5. So subtract that from the 1.5, and now you have a built-in loss of 2%. Someday in the future, you're going to have a loss of 2% real. And then the next year, a minus 1%. So that's 7.5% lower than what it should be. So that adds 7.5. So you had, I forget all the numbers now, you had a built-in gain of 2 plus 7.5. I don't know. I've lost the numbers. But, you know, you could just follow it that way. And if you followed it that way, I've never done the exercise precisely that way, so I don't know for sure that it works. But I think it would sort of kind of work. It might not work perfectly. I don't know all the ins and outs of the math. But I think it would more or less work. And, of course, sometimes the built-in gain or loss would get to be significant. Other times, it would not be significant at all. But you'd always sort of know where you stand. You know, my portfolio value is such and such, but there's this built-in gain or this built-in loss that's going to have to be recognized within the next, you know, 5 years or 10 years. And that's essentially just, you know, that's just the stock return predictor, but simplified. And instead of using a regression analysis, you're just using this sort of a crude way of doing it. And perhaps it doesn't work as well mathematically. You know, somebody will have to tell me, but as I say, my limited brain fastens on to these very simple approaches, and I don't know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But that's how I imagine it. I just imagine myself going through every year, and whenever I get more than 6.5, I feel sort of creeped out because I say, hey, I'm incurring a long-term loss now. And whenever I get less than 6.5, I say, well, I don't like that, but I am incurring this extra gain later on, so that's nice. Anyway, the point here is this whole model, rational investing, you really can boil it down to simple stuff. And the whole model is about, it's anti-volatility. Which, again, everyone should be behind that because volatility is our enemy. Volatility, everybody loves the return on stocks. There's not one person alive who would say that, you know, stocks, everyone agrees. There's no, you know, with all the controversies we've experienced, there's not one person alive who would say a 6.5 real return isn't good. I've never met such a person. So we're all in agreement. 6.5 is good. So why doesn't everybody just love stocks to death? Why is there ever anybody that says anything bad about stocks It's volatility. That's the only problem with stock investing. Volatility. Volatility is the problem. So let's put our heads together and conquer the problem. Let's stop talking about all kinds of things that they talk about, alpha and beta. Yabba dabba doo and zilch. I'm thinking of a podcast with that title. I don't want to talk about alpha and beta anymore. And a sharp ratio. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about how do we eliminate volatility? Isn't that what we need to do? If every single person, I'm getting worked up. You can tell. If every single person loves stocks except for volatility, why don't we do something about volatility? And a lot of people would throw their hands up and say, Rob, there's not a darn thing you can do about volatility. Well, I think there is. Volatility is caused by people. It's caused by people like you and me. Middle-class investors get all hyped up about stocks, and they send prices too high. That's volatility. Or they get all depressed and send them too low. So let's work on the people. The people set the price. Let's work on the people. What are we don't have to trick them. We don't have to deliver electric charges to them. All we need to do is give them accurate information about what the historical data says, that whenever valuations go up, the long-term return drops. And it's numbers. I mean, how can you question numbers? The numbers show this. So let's get the word out. You know, people have a million excuses for not doing it. Eliminate volatility and we're all going to be happier. So I wanted to do a little bit, something I was thinking about. I'm just going to go through some points that I wrote down in notes. I'm going to stop screaming at you. But something that hit me, you know, I write down these notes just before I do the podcast. And something that hit me was, I'll tell a story. I remember telling this story to my boys once. I hope I didn't tell it on the podcast. That would mean that dementia is setting in and I'm starting to repeat myself. But once upon a time, I grew up Northeast Philadelphia and I had some friends I'd hang out with. I think this was high school years, I believe. And you know, sometimes you're hanging around. You know, sometimes when you're a teenager, you have more time than brains, you know. And we do this thing called hanging out, which basically, I guess it was mostly in the summer. You know, you'd sit out on the front steps and just, you know, talk. Talk was fine, but, you know, that doesn't work for too long. You end up doing something else. So one time we went out in this guy's van, and I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't know where we were supposed to be going. And I think, I don't know, fishing or something, but we went somewhere. And we went there, and then the idea comes up, we're going to smoke pot. And I didn't smoke pot. And, you know, I don't want to go into why exactly, but I think the idea in their head is that I was just too straight. And I don't think that's exactly it, but there's something, this is the point I want to make. There's a point to this. The point is, I'll finish the story and then I'll make the point. But so these guys, what they ultimately did was they were friends of mine, so to speak. But they basically, one of them just sort of held me, you know, held my arm so I couldn't resist. And the other one sort of, you know, was threatening to punch me in the stomach if I didn't, you know, smoke the pot, whatever it is. So I did it, you know, for like a couple puffs, and then that was over. I mean, they weren't really going to hurt me, but they wanted to make a point. They wanted me to sort of join the club or whatever. But the point here is, I've pursued this investing thing, you know, to great lengths. And of course, I know that other people wonder, you know, what is it with this guy, you know, and I wonder it sometimes. What is it with me, you know, but something that it is I don't like not to know what's going on. I do not like to know what's going on. I don't think I'd be a good person for that game where you put a handkerchief around your eyes or something and you have to walk blindfolded. I like to know what's going on. I just do. I think I told you another one I've told. It's funny how these little things about your personality reveal themselves in real life. And this is absolutely a true story. I read a lot. I read a book. I think I average a book a week. through my whole life. And, you know, that adds up. That adds up as you put on years. And I'm always looking for a new book. And I don't read too many novels. I mostly read nonfiction, but in recent years, I've read a lot more novels. I've turned away from nonfiction to fiction. But I always read the last page first. And, you know, you always read these reviews of movies and stuff, and people say, oh, don't be a spoiler, don't tell the ending. And I'm like, I want to know the ending. I don't want to be surprised. I like knowing stuff. I enjoy the story every bit as much knowing the ending. It doesn't bother me even a little bit. Don't like surprise parties. You know, if you want to do something for my birthday, just do whatever you want, but don't shout at me, surprise. I don't need that. So the point is, I like to know. That's what this is all about, in a way. You know, I mean, part of rational investing is to acknowledge that we are people, and that we all have personalities, and there's something in the personality of the people who develop the passive investing model that they like. It's like they like numbers. They like things that could be quantified. They don't like emotions, and they don't want to think that emotions affect stock prices. They like stocks because they think of stocks as something, as a project that they can succeed at. That's how they think. And I come along and I say, well, no, it's all these squishy emotions that really matter. And they're like, will you please shut up? You know, you're taking this thing we love, stock investing, and you're ruining it. You're making it all gooey. We don't want gooey. You know, we want Sharpe ratios. Go study the Sharpe ratio, for heaven's sakes. Get out of our hair. But I'm this guy. I look at volatility, and what I see is disguised prices. In other words, I look at my portfolio statement, and the number at the bottom of the portfolio statement isn't the real number. It's not really how much I own, because it's not adjusted for valuation. So it's phony, it's fake, it's fraudulent, and it bugs me. And it, you know, of course, if I could just say that, and everybody would say, well, that's interesting, you know, let's go on about our business, then it, you know, it would sort of vent. That would be the end of it. But when they say, Rob, you're not permitted to say that on the internet, we're going to follow you around for the rest of our lives, making sure you never get to say that, you know, I sort of say, well, why is that? Why does it bother these people? You know, that's another puzzle to solve. Why does it bother these people? Anyway, the point is just, it's something in my personality. I like to know things. And that's what this model is all about. This rational model of investing. It's all about, we don't want to know the S&P number that's reported in the papers. We want to know the S&P number reported in the papers, adjust it for valuations so that we're getting the real number. And that's what P10 tells you. That's what the stock return predictor tells you. By telling you the 10-year return, if the 10-year return, you know, the passive suggests that it's 6.5. They're always telling us the average return is 6.5. Well, it is, but it's 6.5 adjusted for valuations. So I want to know what's the adjusted number today. If I buy stocks today, is my likely return 3% or is it 12%? What is it? And they don't want people to know. So it's this battle between those who want people to know and those who don't want people to know. And I'm, you know, we're a minority, but I'm strongly in the camp of wanting people to know. As I said, I was starting to say this and got distracted. I'd like to develop a widget, and you would just have it at the you know, I'd like, you know, thousands of websites. I mean, you know, it's my dream. And they would all tell people not only the number for the S&P and the Dow, but also the likely 10-year return. And everybody then would make informed decisions. And then the market would work. Then, you know, what the passives claim to be true really would be true. Anyway, I'm probably getting off the point. But volatility is evil. A price increase does not permit us to recover from the economic damage caused by a price drop. Well, what brought this to mind is a lot of people are talking nowadays. There's actually an article, I think it was in the Financial Times I saw today, where a guy's talking about, you know, we're going to get a second chance at a second Great Depression. Everybody was talking last, I don't know, November, December, last October maybe, about a depression. I think I remember the Wall Street Journal ran an article saying there's a 30% chance the economy's going into depression. And we spent tons of money to hold that off. And a lot of people feel today that we've, you know, people aren't happy with the economy. They're not happy with the unemployment numbers, but they feel, you know, we held off the depression. That was good. And it is good, of course, that we held off the depression, of course. But a lot of people, the way they measure these things, you know, they look at the unemployment, but a lot of people, it's personal with the stock market. You know, they're looking at their portfolio. And so last year, when their portfolios were depleted, I think at the high point of the crash, I think it was about, was it a 55% drop? I think it was pretty close to that, something in that neighborhood, 55. It was over 50%, I believe. So people were looking at their, there were people that wouldn't even look at their portfolios, numbers. You know, just, I can't look. So that's bad. Now they're looking and they're saying, yeah, you know, I'm down from where it was, but they're also saying, well, in the last 6 months, you know, I'm up. So, you know, most people didn't have, you know, I don't know, different people had different stock allocations, but if nobody, very few had 100%, so a 50% loss wasn't a 50% portfolio loss. I don't know. It was different amounts for different people. Maybe some people was 30%. And now they've made, you know, half of that back. So it's not so terrible. Not so terrible. Not good. And stocks haven't gone up. You know, they're still down from January 2000 forward. But, you know, there's good ways to look at it and bad ways. And the amount from the crash is not as, you know, it's not so awe-inspiring anymore. So people are feeling, okay, we're mending. And, you know, this article was questioning that. It was just saying, yeah, you know, we've held off, but, and it gave all the reasons. I won't go through them. You know, why there's still economic rot underneath. And I believe this. I don't want to be a bringer of bad news, but I believe that passive investing rots out the economic system. Volatility does this. The two are the same thing to me. You see, rational investing is the investing model that aims to eliminate volatility. Passive investing is the investing model that encourages volatility. How does it encourage volatility? By telling people not to sell stocks when prices get high. The natural human reaction is when prices get high, of course you're going to lower your allocation. Why wouldn't you? Stocks don't offer as good a value proposition. You don't want as much of them. But the passives tell you, no. No need to lower your allocation. You don't need to do that. They're encouraging volatility. It's like we're driving a car and they're taking the brakes off. The brake is selling. That's what makes the market self-regulate. And when you tell people not to sell in response to price increases, you're taking the brakes off the car. So I think when you do that, you create these phony prices. And the phony prices just destroy the economy just across the board. They just destroy the economy in so many ways. And so now prices are going back up, and a lot of people are responding to it personally, and they're saying, well, things aren't that bad. You know, they're not saying they're good, but they're not that bad. And so the idea that I had was, no, you know, you don't get, of course you get your money back. If I don't think we're even getting the money back permanently. I think the higher the stock price goes now, the more likely we're going to see another crash. I think I personally put the odds that we're going to see a crash. I'll define it. What's another crash mean? Another crash means within the next 4 years, we would go to a P10 level below 10. We're now at 19. So that's almost 50% loss within the next 3 or 4 years. That's what I would define as saying we're going to have a second crash in the near-term future. And I put the odds of that at 70, maybe 75%, probably 75%. But I don't know, you know, I don't know. But there's reasons why I believe that. I recorded another podcast. I forget the exact title, but the title was something like, I was wrong. There are economic reasons why we will have another stock crash. And, but the odds go up. In other words, if we had stabilized at a PE10 of 12, I think we could have avoided a second crash. We wouldn't have gotten this money back, but the odds of us crashing would have been diminished. But the higher we go, the more likely we're going to have another crash. And once you have a crash, it can accumulate. In other words, say we had had a tiny crash. Say we had stabilized at 12 And then we had something happen bad, you know, a terrorist attack or something. We might have had a tiny crash, say from 12 to 10, you know, but it wouldn't be that devastating. But if we go up to 20 and the same event happens and it would cause us to go, that would ordinarily cause us to go to 10, well, if you start from 12 and go to 10, you might stop at 10. But if you go from 20 to 10, you might go all the way down to 5. In other words, you build up momentum because every drop in the P10 level is a loss of wealth, and every loss of wealth causes more people to sell stocks. It causes more people to panic. It causes more people to stop spending money. It causes more doom and gloom. So I think the worst thing, I think we've handled this poorly. I had hopes in the early months. People were getting alarmed, and I felt, you know, we're coming together as a nation. We're gonna work on this problem. And I think if we put our heads to it, we clearly have to swallow some medicine. But I think we could avoid a depression if we put our heads to it. But if now, I think it's been irresponsible to allow prices to go back to where they are today. It gives me a bad feeling. And I can't say when, but within the next 3 or 4 years, it's speculation, but it's not totally uninformed speculation. I think the odds are pretty good that we're going to see another crash, and I hope it doesn't become a depression, as this Financial Times article suggested. So what I wanted to basically say, the message here is, people are thinking, you know, most people don't even measure stock, the status of the stock market by the P10 level. They measure it by the Dow number, you know, or the S&P number. The proper way to measure it is by the P10 level. So we've gone from, at the low, we were at 12. We're now at 19. And so people think of that as, well, I think the way a lot of people think of it is they've recovered they don't say we went back to where we were before the crash. Nobody says that. But they say, well, maybe we're halfway back. You know, we went from 12 to 19, we've recovered the money. And what I'm saying is, no, you never recover it. Volatility is in itself an evil. So we shouldn't be thinking, oh, if we go, you know, 14 is fair value. If we go from 14 up to 20 and then back to 14, that's not the same thing as just staying at 14. Economic damage is done by the move up to 14, up to 20, and by the move back down to 14. Same way if it goes the other way. If we go from 14 down to 8, and then we go from 8 back to 14, that's not as good as just staying at 14. There's economic damage done. Volatility is evil. Volatility destroys wealth. I believe this is the most important issue in investing. 70% of our efforts studying investing, teaching about investing, should be aimed at eliminating volatility to the extent we can. If we can't eliminate it, let's diminish it. I think it's possible to virtually eliminate it, but if you think I'm wrong, fine. At least try to diminish it. At least let's do everything we can. And it sure seems to me like a tool like the stock return predictor that teaches people the message that allowing prices to go above fair value hurts you in the end would sure help diminish volatility. So are we back to where we would have been? You know, have we recovered halfway by going from 12 to 19? No. The damage that we incurred was not permanent, but the damage we incurred was long-lasting. You can't make up the damage caused by volatility just by going back to the P10 level that applied before. Why? Well, I had a guest blog entry that I wrote one time at another blog, and it was titled "The Curse of Pretend Money," and I gave numbers in it. I won't be able to recall the numbers. But the basic concept is, think about all the businesses that were started. We were at insane price levels from January 96 through October 2008, 12, 13 years. We were at least double fair value for that entire time period, 3 times fair value for a short time. Think of how many businesses were started. I mean, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of businesses. People started small businesses. Why? There are millions of people who would like to start a small business. The thing that holds a lot of people back is they just don't have the capital. But in those days, millions of people thought they had the capital. They didn't. They didn't in any real sense. They maybe had barely enough, you know, for the retirement plan. But they thought they had excess capital because stocks were priced at 2 to 3 times their real value. So these people started businesses. What do you think the chances are of those businesses surviving if they were undercapitalized? And now the money has gone poof. Now, does going from 12 to 19 mean those businesses recover? No. And it might help. Might help, at least temporarily, because the owner was maybe ready to go under, and now he's got a little more money in his portfolio and he can hang on a little more. That might be. But it doesn't put him back where he would have been if we had not seen the volatility in the first place. Because for one thing, he never would have founded the business in the first place. He would have waited until he had the right amount of capital to do it. But secondly, there's all kinds of things that happened when we had that drop down to 12. I mean, you know, one thing is just he lost confidence. I mean, just losing confidence alone can do it. You've got to have confidence to take on the world. And that was a punch in the stomach. But another thing is, you know, these people incur debt. They've had a downsize. They've had a layoff employees. Those changes, what happens when we have the volatility and then the response to the volatility work its way through the system, it doesn't. People talk about economic events as if these things just happen in a day and then they're over and then they go on to the next story, the next day's headlines. But what happens is these bad things happen and they're like little time bombs. It takes 3 years for the bomb to explode. The business has been undercapitalized. The guy's in debt. But he's going to try to hang on. He doesn't want to lose his business. But his odds of being able to hang on maybe went from 80%, you know, down to 30% with that loss of capital. And so it's he might survive. Some of them will survive. Some will get lucky. There's always some that get lucky, but many are not. But all the ones that were going to fail didn't fail when we were 12. They're going to be failing over the course of the next few years. And as each new one fails, that has ramifications that work their way through the economy. That means people lose jobs. It means marriages fail. And doom and gloom spreads. People tell stories about these things. So the volatility itself is a negative. You can't just look at it as you know, what a lot of people do. In other words, the way the passives think about stocks is they say, oh, stocks are great. It's almost like I don't know if there is such a measure. Maybe there is such a measure. It's almost like we should have a volatility measure. In other words, they say, oh, 6.5, and they compare that to something like, I don't know, let's just say, say certificates of deposit paid 3% real. I think that's a little high, but say they did. And they say, well, stocks pay double. They make it sound like stocks are twice as good. But when you count in this volatility, the negatives of it, it's not necessarily such a good thing. But stocks would clearly be superior if you could eliminate the volatility. In other words, the volatility is really the only negative of stocks, but it's a big negative. And it's not just a big negative to the individual investor. It's not like you can say, I made half the money back I lost in the crash. The damage that was done to the economy lingers on, and that damage is gonna hurt you. It's gonna hurt, you know, not only you, but you're gonna pay your part of the price for it. Certainly, if we go into a depression, every last one of us suffers. Even the rationals are destroyed. So everyone suffers. But even if we go into a prolonged recession, we're all paying a price. And it's volatility causing that price. You have to ask at some point, is the stock market even worth having? I mean, you know, not that we're going to do away with it, but we all think these returns are so great. But I have pointed out, you know, many times that we've had 4 economic crises in the United States from 1900 forward. And each and every one of them was preceded by a time in which we hit a P10 level of 26. There's not one time we ever hit a P10 level of 26 and didn't have an economic crisis. The correlation is perfect. What that tells me is that stock volatility puts intense pressure on this, on our economy. And we've got to start caring about that. We've got to stop talking about investing as if it's all just individuals playing with their money. They're playing with our economic and even our political system. Because when the economic system fails, when people's retirements fail, when people's businesses fail, when people's marriages fail, it has political ramifications. You have all this anger, which is no good. So volatility, you know, volatility is the devil. I mean, we just got to do something about it. We can't just, people talk about it as if it's just a fact of life and there's nothing you can do about it. Why can't we? Again, volatility is it's not caused by some machine. It's caused by people. People can be persuaded of things. People can be educated. You know, they talk. I had a podcast. What did I say? Did I say volatility is like pollution? Something is like pollution. It might have been volatility. And, you know, do we just accept pollution? There was a time when we did. Nobody did anything about it. And the problem got big enough that people said we have to do something about it. Well, I think the problem of volatility has gotten big enough. We have to do something about it. Stop whining about it and complaining about it and do something about it. How do we stop volatility? I want John Bogle to tell us. What would he do? What's his plan of attack? I want Warren Buffett to say, what's his plan of attack? And all the others. What's your plan of attack on volatility on a going forward basis? Forget anything that's been said in the past. Starting today, starting here, starting now, what are we going to do about volatility so that it stops destroying us? Well, you know, what's your program? I gave 4 hours of it on the Future of Investing podcast series. You know, maybe some of those ideas are stupid. I believe a couple of them are not stupid. My personal belief, I mean, I wouldn't have put any of them forward if I thought they were stupid. But I'm willing to say some of them, you know, maybe you'll find some holes in. But I have a hard time understanding why we can't just educate people about what the historical data tells us about the 10-year return at different price levels. It sure seems that there are many people, even people I have greatest respect for, sharp people like Jeremy Grantham, who understand the valuations question and are straight shooters, straight as the day is long. But Jeremy Grantham, you know, he has this cynical throw up his hands approach. You know, what are we going to learn from this crash? He says, well, we'll learn a lot in the short term, a little bit in the medium term, and nothing in the long term. In other words, we're just going to do it all over again. I know where he's coming from. I know why he says it. But that's, it doesn't cut it, in my assessment. You know, it's too insular. We have to reach out to other people. We have to care. And you just don't throw your hands up and say, well, yeah, you know, the water's polluted. The animals are endangered. Let them die. You know, do something. Do something, man. You write a book, report a podcast, pass some legislation. Do something. And the most simple thing we could do is just let people know the numbers. Let them know. January 2000, all the experts were telling people, put your money in stocks. And the historical stock return data was telling us that the most likely long-term return of stocks was a negative number. If people knew that, they would have been selling stocks, and we wouldn't have had that much volatility as we experienced. So there are things that can be done. It's not hopeless. It's not hopeless. Wherever people are involved, it's not hopeless. But in this case, it's not like you're trying to teach teenagers not to have sex. You know, we're trying to tell people how to retire 5 years sooner. This should be an easy sell. This is all upside, no downside. Somebody's got to say it. I mentioned here that, you know, marriages, executives and managers, people lose their jobs in this volatility. How many people lost their jobs when we went down to a 12 P/10 level? Well, it's very hard for well-paid executives and managers to replace their jobs. You know, if you lose a job at minimum wage, you often can find another. But if you're a high-paid executive or manager that's 50 years old, you're going to have a hard time finding a replacement job. So you've suffered a bone-crushing loss just like that. You don't need any more stock crash. That's volatility. You wouldn't have lost that job. You know, maybe you wouldn't have gotten the job without the upward volatility. Maybe you got the job in 96 because these businesses had more money than they knew what to do with. So maybe it helped you on that end, but you would have been better off without that help if you end up losing it on the downside. You would have been better off then taking a different job that maybe paid a little less, but that would be stable. In other words, phony money leads to the creation of phony jobs, and phony jobs leads to destroyed lives. I'm looking for reality, the reality principle. I don't want a phony job. I want a real job. I want you to have a real job. And when stocks are valued at three times fair value and everybody's throwing money around, phony jobs get created, and the phony jobs go poof. But the person filling the phony job is still hanging around and still needs to eat. Volatility is evil. A price increase does not permit us to recover from the economic damage caused by a price drop. Marriages were destroyed. They don't talk about that sort of thing in investing school. Marriages were destroyed. You know, there's always some marriages on the borderline. I mean, it'd be nice to think that nobody's marriage would be destroyed because of a stock crash. But there's always some marriages that are on the borderline where they're under stress. But if they can get through another 6 months, they can patch things up. They can start healing. And there's a stock crash. And friction develops or increases. Fear increases. Marriages are destroyed. Does that count? Do they figure that into the Sharpe ratio? Jim Wyant, publisher of IndexUniverse.com, he said, any articles you write for this site, you have to mention the Sharpe ratio, Rob. Does the Sharpe ratio tell people how many marriages are lost by your volatility of the passive investing model? Man, what did they put in my cornflakes today? Marriages were destroyed. Stimulus bills are passed. Some people think the stimulus bill was wonderful. Some people think it was awful. All I know is it cost us a lot of money. If we didn't have the crazy volatility. Now, some of the things in the stimulus bill were probably good things. They could have been passed regardless. But the point is we had to spend more than we would have spent if we hadn't had this excess volatility. So why not do something about it? Instead of passing a stimulus bill in response to volatility, why not take the bull by the horns and take some steps to diminish the volatility before it develops? You know, what do they tell the people in New Orleans? You know, don't build your house where there's going to be a flood. Well, we've seen what volatility does to humans and other living things. How about taking some steps to stop it? I've got, you know, go to the podcast. I don't remember them all, but I've got 30-some ideas. And I wrote them while I was sitting at my boy's baseball game. John Bogle's been around longer than I have. It's hard for me to imagine he couldn't come up with 30 of his own. And Warren Buffett and lots of others. And if we got all this mental energy working together to eliminate volatility, we put a man on the moon. You know, John Kennedy stood on a platform and said, we're going to put a man on the moon in 10 years. How about we're going to eliminate stock volatility or we're going to cut it in half? I say eliminate it. I say reach for the stars. But let's do something. And just doing something would make us feel better about ourselves. All this jibber-jabber about our, you know, ban on honest posting. You know, you can't say that. What a waste of time. Do something constructive and you start feeling good. Start feeling good. The sun starts shining again. You're never going to feel good when you haven't even tried. When's the last time you read an article in the Wall Street Journal about stop, you know, they talk about the effect of volatility. How, when's the last time you read a constructive article about how to end it? Why? Why not? We fight to end cancer? Can we fight to end stock volatility? Can we try? Can we educate people so that they know volatility is not in their best interest? And the point here is we have millions of people invested in the stock market. Volatility hurts every single one of them. Every single one of them, it's in their self-interest to stop volatility. Motivate people and they'll do it. And you don't have to have one guy digging a trench. You know, you've got millions digging. And the work goes fast with millions. And they all can educate their kids. Generations of volatility suppression. Early retirements have failed. That's how this all got started, on an early retirement board. How many people use those safe withdrawal rate studies have seen their early retirement fail? One of the saddest things, whenever these questions are discussed, somebody will bring it up, they'll say, oh, the ones that didn't fail, they're here bragging. You know, the ones that were lucky, they got on the lucky side of volatility. John Graney was on the lucky side of volatility. He happened to accumulate wealth at the right time, the biggest bull market in history. So yeah, he's sailing. He's lost money, but he's not lost so much that his retirement's going to fail. But how about the people who came after him? People who retired in January 2000 and they've gone 10 years with a negative stock return. Failed retirements. They don't speak up. They don't go to the boards. They're ashamed. They're my community. They're my friends. The hell with the community members. They're my friends. They're too ashamed to speak up. They shouldn't be ashamed. The ones who gave them the wrong numbers in the retirement studies are the ones that should be ashamed. And frankly, we all should be ashamed. This wasn't done by John Graney. This was a show put on by millions. Anybody who sat on his or her hands as stock prices went up and up and up to these insane, sick levels played a role in causing all of those failed retirements. Do I say that to make you feel bad? No. I think it would make you feel good if you did something about it. So that, you know, well, look, we can't redo what happened. We can't change it. But we sure as shooting can do something about the future. And when our energy is going in that direction instead of the cover-up, you feel good inside. Don't think that doesn't matter. That's how my saving plan worked. You know, I started with little things and I started to feel better and better and better about my financial circumstances. And, you know, each time I felt better, that motivated me to do more. So each step we take to eliminate volatility, volatility is evil. Each step we take, we feel better. We will feel better. If we can get over the shame that's holding us back. Of course, there's the spending. You know, this was the curse of pretend money. All these people, we all looked at our portfolio statements and we all thought we had three times what we really had. And of course, we all bought houses bigger than we otherwise would have and cars that we wouldn't have bought and vacations. And we can't get that money back. That's money lost to volatility. Volatility is evil. You can't get the money back. So what people focus on now, they say, oh, well, no sense talking about it. I can't get the money back. Well, that part is true. There's no sense crying over something that's done. But what are we going to do it again? Whatever age you are, you've got years ahead of you. I mean, if you're 65, you might live to 95. You might have 30 more years in the stock market. Whatever age you are, it makes sense. To, you know, the benefits of eliminating or diminishing volatility are so great that it makes sense for every single middle-class person to be involved in this effort, I believe. It would help us plan our financial futures. Volatility is evil. Businesses, you know, we're all talk about this market. All these people that push, passive investing, they've got this market idea in their head. The market's always right. What kind of market is it when resources are being misallocated? There are all kinds of businesses that were spendthrift businesses, you know, the people that built these homes that were too big, the McMansions, whatever they're called. These businesses were riding high because stock statements were reporting numbers three times fair value. Right? Those businesses, there wouldn't have been so many of them. If the market had been functioning properly, those businesses would have been, a lot of them would have failed. And we wouldn't have wasted so much money. So it's not a free market. It's not a free market when people don't have the information they need to make effective decisions about selling stocks. One, there's two effective decisions you can make in stocks, to buy and to sell. And with passive investing, there's only one, to buy. And the sell part is thrown in the trash, doesn't get discussed. And that's 50% of stock investing. If you don't even examine when to sell, you can't possibly know the right time to do it. If people had known when to sell, a lot of these spendthrift businesses would not have done so well and would not have caused such economic damage to our entire nation. A lot of businesses that tried to help people save failed because they couldn't competitively make it. Because the edge was being given to the ones, you know, that appealed to people's baser instincts. Everybody wants to spend on luxuries. That's just human nature. That's just how we are. I don't really think it's anything to be ashamed of. It's just how we are. The comparison I always make is passive investing. It's like wanting to eat six pieces of chocolate cake. We all want to believe that these phony baloney price increases from the 90s are real. Just like we all want to eat six pieces of chocolate cake. But when you go to a nutritionist, the nutritionist doesn't say, hey, yeah, go for it. Eat the six pieces of chocolate cake. That's smart. The experts tell you, yeah, that's a good idea. They tell you, no, that's Looney Tunes. You got to resist that urge. That's what stock investing advice should be all about. It should be all about helping people resist the urge to destroy themselves through the creation of volatility. When prices go up the way they did in the 90s, that's volatility, that's gibberish, that's nonsense, we need to stop it. And when prices go down like they did in 2008, that's also nonsense. And if we didn't have the phony buildups, we wouldn't have the phony knockdowns. So, what we're all about at PassionSaving.com is stopping volatility. Are you with us or are you against us? John Bogle? Are you with us or are you against us, Warren Buffett? We need some big time hitters. How did they take on pollution? You know, there was a woman wrote a book, I don't know all the history, but she wrote a book, Silver Spring. Rachel, I don't remember her last name. I think it was Rachel. And then they got some big hitters, you know? They got some politicians, and they united some people, and people got to work, and now there's all kinds of things being done. You know, we haven't solved the problem, but there's all kinds of things being done. I mean, people are putting efforts into it, so at least we're trying. Same thing with the space mission. Same thing with curing diseases that we've cured. All these things. Humans can do wonderful things when they unite. And with purpose. I think it's time to start uniting with purpose on the issue of stock volatility. Thank you.
We'll be right back.